Michael Brown here. I am so glad we get to spend this time together on the Line of Fire. Sit back, enjoy the program. If it blesses you, share it with a friend. What is life? And how does science explain the origins of life? And is science pointing away from God or to God? Today we'll hear from a learned biochemist.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Tackling the controversies, engaging the culture, challenging the status quo, and taking your calls. Dr. Brown is the director of Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Call now at 866-34-TRUTH and get into the line of fire.
All right, I've got a very simple question for you today, but it's a lot more complex than it might sound. What is life? What is life? Can science explain to us what life is? Can science explain to us the origins of life? Does the best science point us in the direction of a creator God or away from a creator God? Michael Brown, thank you for joining us today on the Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Or on Facebook, Ask Dr. Brown. Ask Dr. Brown. I am delighted to have with me on the air today Dr. Fuzz Rana, author of the brand new book, Creating Life in the Lab, and Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, PhD from Ohio University. In the time it took for me to give that introduction, Dr. Rana has forgotten more about biochemistry than I have learned in my life. Thank you, Fuzz, for being with us on the air today.
Well, thank you, Michael, for having me.
Could you tell me the proper pronunciation of your full first name?
Sure, it's Fuzzle.
Fuzzle, all right.
Yes, yeah. It's my dad was from India, so it's an Urdu name, and that's why I go by Fuzz.
All right. Well,
it's easier on everybody.
Now, you know, my areas of scholarship and expertise are in Bible and biblical languages and apologetics, but there's kind of a black hole in my life scientifically because during my high school years during science, I was just getting high. Then we went on strike for a new kind of school where we didn't have any formal classes, so I had no science. And then I took no science classes in college or grad school, right through my PhD. So I've been trying to make up for that black hole, but I was quite serious in terms of what you know versus what I know in biochemistry. And the reason it's a delight to have you on the air is because many of us that don't have a strong scientific background hear the arguments from the atheists, many of them themselves biologists, chemists, learned scholars, astronomers, and they're pretty much telling us that if you had half a brain working and knew what they knew, you couldn't possibly believe in a God. That's not your own personal story, is it?
No, not at all. In fact, I believe that science very powerfully points to the necessity of a creator. I find that no matter what the discipline of science is, there's overwhelming evidence for the necessity of a creator being involved in the origins of the universe, the origins of life. And when we look at life, when we look at the universe itself, we see elegant evidence for design as well. So I see science revealing truths about nature that are fully compatible with not only God's existence, but I think the truthfulness of what Scripture teaches us.
Now, you didn't always believe this way, did you?
No, not at all. In fact, I didn't grow up in a Christian home whatsoever. As I mentioned, my father was from India, and he was actually a Muslim. And I have an interesting background. My mom, who comes from a German background, was a non-practicing Catholic when she and my father married. And so when I grew up, my parents had agreed to disagree on religion, and we really didn't receive any kind of religious training whatsoever. My father was a nuclear physicist. My mom was a science and math teacher. So we grew up in a household where, whether we liked it or not, science was very much part of our day-to-day existence. And my parents always encouraged and coerced it sometimes, my brother and I, to take courses in science and math. And that ultimately led me to become interested, net effect, in becoming a biochemist. And so when I took courses in college in chemistry and biology as part of that preparation, I would probably have classified myself as someone who believed in God, but in a practical sense, God wasn't really important to me whatsoever. I was a pragmatic atheist, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And But the professors I admired the most taught me that evolution is the way to explain the origin of life and the history of life, and I uncritically accepted what they were teaching. Many of them were anti-Christian in their perspective, and I felt comfortable in that environment. But when I went to graduate school to pursue a PhD in biochemistry, I began doing my own research, began reading the scientific literature, began taking advanced courses in biochemistry, and it was at that point I very quickly came to the recognition that these systems are far more complex than I would have ever imagined as a young student, as an undergraduate. And it's not only that the systems inside the cell are complex, it's they're incredibly elegant and incredibly sophisticated. They're incredibly clever. It's as if a mind had put them together. And it was at that point I became interested in how do scientists explain where these systems come from? That's called the origin of life question. And when I looked at the explanation that was being suggested, it just didn't seem to make any sense to me. It just didn't work the way that these scientists were claiming that it would have had to have worked. I came to the conviction. Go ahead.
So you can't be pegged then. It's difficult for some skeptic or some hardcore atheist to peg you because you weren't raised in a religious home. You didn't go through some personal crisis where you were trying to find God. It wasn't a fundamentalist trying to cling to what the Bible woodenly says. I have to believe it. It was scientific evidence that pointed you in the direction of an intelligent creator.
That's exactly right. I came to the conviction that chemistry and biology, or chemistry and physics, could not generate life. That there had to be a mind that was behind it all. And once you come to that conviction, it starts leading to far more interesting and important questions, I believe, namely, who is that creator and how do I relate to the creator? And so I went on a six-month journey trying to answer those questions, and it was through a number of circumstances that I wound up sitting in a pastor's home, and he challenged me to read the Bible and see if I thought it was true. Because up to that point, I had never opened up the Bible in any serious manner and read anything from it. And I responded to his challenge, because at that point I was at least open. And as I read through the Gospel of Matthew, and specifically the Sermon on the Mount, I became convinced that Jesus must be who Christians claim him to be. It was more of a religious experience, or I would say a divine intuition, but it was reading through Scripture that convinced me that it must be Jesus, and that what Jesus taught about my sin nature was very much true, and that there's no way that I could live a life that would be a life that I would desire to live that would adhere to what he would expect. And so I recognized my sin, my need for a Savior, but was impressed with the authority by the way in which Jesus taught. And again, I, you know, believe it was divine revelation or divine insight that allowed me to embrace the Christian faith. So it was God revealed through nature, through biochemistry, and then also Jesus revealed through Scripture that brought me to the Christian faith.
So it would be similar on a certain level to what happened to C.S. Lewis. Of course, he was an atheist and then intellectually became convinced of theism, and then through an encounter with God, became a follower of Jesus.
Yes, it would be similar to that, although I would never put myself in the same category as C.S. Lewis. But yes, exactly right.
All right, I've got a ton of questions, some very specific, some general. Let me start with a general question. We've got about a minute and a half before the break, so we'll only be able to get started here. I was flying somewhere last year before, whatever, talking to a fellow who headed up an institute that only taught PhD students in advanced scientific subjects. That's all they did. And he himself said he was an atheist, and he was explaining to me how if you look in certain learned professions, biologists, etc., that the higher you get up in terms of degrees, when you get up to the PhD, biologist, biochemist, chemist, etc., that it's an unbelievably high number of atheists. To him, it was because the evidence was so clear. Get us started on an answer to this, then we'll come back on the other side of the break. Why this high degree of skepticism among so many of these advanced scholars?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is there's actually a fairly high degree of belief among people in the sciences. In fact, some of the latest surveys I saw showed about a 40% belief in God, in a personal God, among scientists across, you know, a variety of disciplines. So, first of all, while that's oftentimes the perception that people have, including people within the scientific community, the fact of the matter is there's a fairly high level of belief. But I believe at the end of the day, those people who are within those disciplines who reject God are not doing it because of the evidence or the lack of the evidence, but rather they're using their intellect as an excuse for denying the Creator's existence.
Got it. I understand, and I think that's a sound and fair answer. Right? We come back, we'll talk about what is life, the question of the origins of life, and then what about, I mean, synthetic biology and creating life in the lab, is that possible? What does it say to us as believers? We'll take it up with Dr. Ron on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown with my special guest, Dr. Fuzz Rana, author of the book Creating Life and the Lab, Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. I am going to dominate this time with my questions for the guests, but I may be able to grab a call or two. 866-34-TRUTH. Online, AskDrBrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire for a link to Reasons to Believe website and to the new book by Fuzz. Before the break, we were talking about skepticism among scientists, and you're saying that there's another side to the story, that many of them are believers in God. Why don't we hear that as much?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think part of it is because many times people who are believers within the scientific community tend to be rather quiet about their belief. The feeling is that they are going to go against the grain, and they themselves are not aware of the high level of belief that exists among scientists. But it, consistently, when you see surveys of the scientific community, the number of people that report belief in a personal God is actually quite high. So, you know, it's encouraging, and from where I stand in terms of the ministry that we do, where we travel around the country and speak on university campuses, I'm aware of a lot of incredibly sophisticated, incredibly intelligent, world-class scientists who are believers in Jesus Christ. So that the level of belief is a lot higher, and I think part of it is just timidity on the part of those in the scientific community who are believers, because there are consequences sometimes to espousing belief in Christ, and particularly within the sciences.
All right, so you've published in scientific peer-reviewed journals, Biochemistry, Journal of Microbiological Methods, etc. Is there some type of intimidation or discrimination against folks that come to the table with strong beliefs? Have you encountered that personally?
I actually have not ever encountered it in terms of how it's impacted me personally. I do know of some stories where people have been persecuted because of their beliefs, but that tends to be, it happens, but it doesn't happen as often as you would think it does. But those situations are so horrific and so high profile that I think it causes people who are believers to be a lot more timid than they have to be. And I think there are many people in the scientific community who would not espouse belief in God who are atheists, who are at least reasonably fair-minded about things. But again, there is a minority that usually is pretty vocal and pretty aggressive, who are atheists, who will challenge people who are Christians in the scientific disciplines, and will try to do what they can to make their life miserable. It's probably similar to other areas of life as well. Mm-hmm. You know, being a believer isn't always necessarily the most popular position to hold, and you know, there are people out there that do not like Christians and want to do what they can to embarrass Christians and attack them.
Right, and it's the same principle: if you save your life, you lose it. If you lose your life, you find it. That we have to have a moral courage to speak up what's right. And sometimes, even when we're in the majority, we feel like the minority because of the pressure of the spirit of the world, the spirit of the age. You said that recent surveys would indicate as many as 40% of scientists are believers. Again, I'm looking at this scientifically from an uneducated layman's perspective, trying to catch up in my learning, but clearly from a layman's perspective. I'm always amazed by the evidence. I'm blown away. It's so clear to me that science doesn't have an answer for the origins of life, or if science can even define life. So let's focus in on that a little bit more. First, the question of what is life, and then does science have an answer for the origin of life?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that nobody can define what life is from a scientific perspective. And in fact, there's a rich history over the last 200 years of scientists attempting to define what life is and coming up short time and time again. And so what scientists end up doing is describing characteristics that are common to all life on Earth, but nobody can really define what life is. And in fact, that was so intriguing to me. That was one of the first things I learned in biology when I was in college. The first college class I took was Biology 101, and the first day of class, the professor made that very point. And that's what really got me excited about the idea of biochemistry, because I felt like if there was any discipline that had any chance of answering that question, it was going to be biochemistry. But, you know, again, we are no closer to understanding how to define life now than we have ever been in the history of science.
So there's certain things that science just really can't tell us. I don't want to get on a tangent with this, but can science tell us what is beautiful, for example?
Well, of course not. No, it can't. And, you know, science can't explain even the beginning of the universe. I mean, we know that the universe had a beginning, but, again, science is incapable of answering the question, you know, what was there before the universe began, and how did the universe come into existence? And so there's a lot of questions that science just simply is not able to adequately address, and it's even questions sometimes that we would think should very much be under the purview of science. You know, again, you know, like, what is life? And yet, ironically, you and I are very good at looking at something and saying, well, that's alive and that isn't alive. But yet science can't, you know, come up with an adequate definition of exactly what is life.
Science can't define things like love either. So it's a strange thing to think that science, or science can't even tell us what goodness is on an essential level. And yet there are scientists who want to tell us that based on science, there is no God. I mean, isn't that a bizarre concept with your learning and your faith perspective, that science is going to prove to us there is no God?
Yeah, you know, and that's a really good point that you're bringing up, because so oftentimes when we'll travel around to university campuses and present a scientific case for God's existence, you know, people who are scientists will oftentimes object, and they'll object by saying, well, you can't put God in a test tube. Science can't prove that God exists. But yet, on the other hand, these same scientists will then, just a few minutes later, give you all the scientific reasons why they think God doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if science can prove God doesn't exist, then in principle it can prove that God does exist. So, you know, these guys talk out of both sides of their mouths sometimes.
Right. It is true. And obviously the idea of proving a negative throughout the entire universe and before time began is so absurd. And yet they'll arrogantly look at us. They are the brights because they know better. And again, I look at things and I figure, you know, the day is going to come when every honest scientist is going to have to recognize, just on the evidence, the more we learn, the reality of God. So when we come back, I want to start to focus on some of your areas of specialization, beginning with the cell. And then this whole discussion of creating life in the lab. But let me ask this, 30 seconds before the break. Do you ever hear news of scientific discoveries that rattle you or challenge your faith at all?
Occasionally I do, but usually when I dig into the details, I oftentimes will find that what appears on the surface to be troubling actually turns out to be a very powerful piece of evidence in favor of the faith.
Got it. So there is that appearance that, oh no, they really scored a point. And then the more you look into it, it's the exact opposite. All right, we'll come back. We'll start to focus on the cell and then the subject of creating life in the lab. My guest, Dr. Fuzz Rana, his new book, Creating Life in the Lab. For links to the Reason to Believe website and to this important new book, highly praised by Hank Hanegraaff, Paul Copan, and others, go to AskDrBrown.org. Click on the Line of Fire. Welcome back to the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, delighted to have with me Dr. Fuzz Rana, Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe and author of the new book, Creating Life in the Lab, 866-34-TRUTH. I will try to get to a few calls for our guest. Fuzz, you had a whole book, which I bought when it came out, The Cell's Design. And again, I'm looking at it from an untrained, non-scientific background, but I'm devastated. I'm amazed that the deeper you get in to human chemistry and biology and our very makeup, it seems it gets more and more complex and clearly designed with information and so on. So tell us the significance of the cell. And obviously, you're widely experienced in talking to people who don't have the background, but the significance of this is mind-boggling in terms of evidence for God.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that I find to this very day absolutely startling as a biochemist is that the biochemical systems inside the cell have as their defining characteristics, as their defining features, the same characteristics that you would see in a human design. So in other words, when human beings design an object or a system, when they create, when we invent, that which we make has certain signatures that indicate the work of a mind. And you see those same characteristics inside the cell. So by analogy, if you know these characteristics are evidence for the work of a human mind and we see them inside the cell, I believe that that's very powerful evidence that the cell is indeed designed by a creator. And in fact, a creator in whose image we are built, or we are designed, or we are created. And so an example real quickly would be protein complexes inside the cell. Proteins are large molecules that play a very important role in virtually every cell operation and cell structure. And it turns out that these proteins will form complexes with each other. And in many instances, those complexes are operating as machines, as literal machines at a molecular level. But what's remarkable about that is that a lot of those machines are almost identical in terms of their makeup to human machines, in terms of their structure and operation. So, for example, there are machines that have rotors and stators and drive shafts and bushings and universal joints and pumps and things like that. Lever arms, hinges, and these machine-like qualities are, again, absolutely astounding and virtually identical to man-made machines, but the machines inside the cell operate with so much greater efficiency and elegance than anything that a human being could construct. And so that would just be an example, a very simple example of the types of systems that you see inside the cell that, again, I think points to the work of a mind. And at the very basis, the cell is an information system. And the information inside the cell, DNA and proteins are information-harboring molecules, but the way that that information is structured, the way that it is handled by inside the cell is almost, again, identical to how computers operate. So that the cell could be thought of as an incredibly sophisticated computer system. And again, we know that computers just simply don't happen by chance, but rather represent the work of intelligent designers. And so, likewise, that's another reason why we could look at the cell and say this must be the work of a creator.
All right. So two questions to follow up on that. The first is, why can't it be natural selection, given billions and billions and billions of years, that eventually, okay, this didn't work, so this works. Now this is built on that, and now, okay, this didn't work, but this did work. So you end up with these amazingly complex structures, but given enough billions of years, it's not a miracle, and it doesn't need a God.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a number of ways to tackle that question, but one of them is that we now have a pretty good understanding of what is the bare essential requirements for life. Just what type of biochemical complexity do you need for an entity to be even recognized as a living entity, to begin to operate like a life form? And it turns out that you need probably close to 400 different genes for an organism to be alive. And each gene represents a different type of protein. So you're going to need to have minimally 400 different types of proteins coming together all at once in order for that entity to operate like a living entity. And you can't have 200 proteins and that system somehow function. Everything has to be in place all at once. And not only do they all have to be present, but the way in which they are organized and structured in the cell has to be very precise. If the organization of those proteins is any way, shape, or form altered, the cell will not be able to function as a living entity. And so there's just no way that a process driven by natural selection and random variation could ever cobble together life over enough, you know, over billions of years, because everything has to happen all at once in order for life to be possible.
Got it. And again, as you're simplifying that, the more we look at the everything involved in that equation, the more mind-boggling it becomes, and the more impossible it becomes that they're all there, and it just happened in one shot. Okay, other question is this. There are those scientists who are atheists and would mock our faith, but they're involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So they are sending out messages, coded messages, mathematically laid out, that only an intelligence could put out, looking for an intelligent response. Now, of course, to me, there's a bit of an arrogance in that approach, saying that we actually can send out a message that only an intelligent being could respond to, but that, you know, that our intelligence is really the intelligence. But isn't the very premise of what they're doing, saying that certain things and certain sequences put together certain ways, presuppose and require intelligence? So if we got a response back that would indicate intelligence, don't you have something abundantly beyond that in the cell or DNA already?
Oh, yes, you do. And this was something that I had mentioned earlier, is that, again, the cell is built around information systems. You know, DNA is an information-harboring molecule. Proteins harbor information. And the information in the DNA molecule is structured in the same way that we would structure information. People who are experts in information theory note that the way in which the information is organized in the cell is similar to how human language is organized. And you have codes that are built into the information systems of the cell. DNA can only harbor information and then express that information in the form of proteins through the use of something called the genetic code. And one of the most important insights, I believe, that has come in recent years is that the code is extremely optimized. The rules that make up the code that sits at the very heart of the cell's information systems, and in fact, you could say even defines biochemistry itself, is exquisitely designed and exquisitely optimized. And so, you know, as you point out, all of our experience teaches us that, you know, information signifies intelligence. And, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is predicated on that very assumption. Yet when biologists look at the cell and recognize these features of the cell, they don't draw the same conclusion, and I think part of that reason is a philosophical blindness that, mm-hmm. you know, you have to appeal to a creator in order to make sense of that, and they don't want to go down that path.
Right, so they'll have potentially multiple universes and aliens, but not God. All right, more with Dr. Fuzz Rana, when we return. Michael Brown, welcome back to The Line of Fire. My guest today, Dr. Fuzzle Rana, author of the new book, Creating Life in the Lab, and Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, a PhD in biochemistry. Fuzz, again, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let me grab a call, and then I want to talk to you specifically about your new book. James in Winston-Salem, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Yes, hello, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
My question, it goes back to what you were talking about, which I thought were good examples of what science couldn't do, which is explain love and beauty, right? And what I would like for you to do is to approach those two concepts kind of like the materialism argument, that really the argument would be that really what you're talking about there is chemical reactions in the brain on a subjective level, and you're describing those experiences as being love or experiencing beauty, but materialism say, no, that's just chemical reactions going on.
All right, so Fuzz, how much then does science really have the domain to talk about these things? If these are merely material reactions, do they mean anything? If they're just, you know, atoms or neurons firing, or does it have to be something more?
And does that really undermine science? Can you really say that, well, science can't answer those questions? If maybe science, maybe that's science's answer to those questions.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's true that, you know, let's say if you, you know, you're able to measure activity in the brain in response to, you know, different types of stimuli, different types of input, and I think it's very easy to fall into the trap to think, well, just because we can see activity in the brain, that somehow means that we understand what love is. But rather, what you're just simply noting is that there is a response that we would have as human beings to, you know, feelings of love, to something that's beautiful, but that doesn't necessarily mean that science is able to say what one thing, why one thing is beautiful and another thing is not, or why we have certain feelings of love towards one individual and not love towards another individual, or, you know, in the case of the Christian faith, how we would actually have love towards an individual who otherwise we might actually, by all rights, actually hate. So, you know, I don't think that science, just because they can measure brain activity, is anywhere closer to understanding what the phenomena of love or the phenomena of beauty is. And I think it's fallacious to think that just because there's brain activity, you understand what's going on, or you understand the phenomena in its, you know, in its essence.
Got it. And I think, James, thank you for the question. Again, I think it helps us put science in the proper place. So the big challenge now, what if scientists could, quote, create life, something synthetic, but it's life. They could create it in the lab. You've got a whole book on that. I want to take the last few minutes of the show to focus on this, creating life in the lab, how new discoveries in synthetic biology make a case for the creator. I thought this makes a case against the creator.
Well, you know, that's what you hear coming from the scientific community, is the idea that if we can go in the lab and create life in the lab, that means there's nothing special about life. That means that a creator isn't necessary. And the fact of the matter is the scientific community has enough understanding of how life works at a fundamental level and has developed techniques to manipulate biochemical systems sufficiently that a number of different research groups are on the cusp of being able to create something in the lab that could arguably be called life and an artificial life form, a synthetic life form. But the irony here is that when this is accomplished, this, I think, is going to represent one of the most powerful evidences for a creator and for intelligent design, because what's striking to me as a biochemist is this, that these researchers are engaged in this activity only because they developed an incredible database of knowledge and insight into how the cell works. They are employing incredibly ingenious strategies to carry out this work. They are utilizing incredibly sophisticated equipment in the laboratory, and the manipulations that are required involve extensive training and extensive expertise and extensive care. I mean, what they are in effect showing empirically in the lab is this, that if you don't have intelligent agents involved, you cannot create life whatsoever from non-life. So to me, the irony here is that even though the pronouncements are that if we create life in the lab, God isn't necessary, the fact of the matter is what they've shown is that you've got to have intelligent agents to make life from non-life. And so to extrapolate that, when we look at the cell, how much more do you need a creator?
Got it. So life doesn't just happen, and the cell didn't just appear. All right, we'll take a couple more minutes with Fuzz Rana on the other side of the break. Author of the new book, Creating Life in the Lab. I want him to tell us about reasons to believe and the resources that they can help you with as you grow in your faith and share it with others. Well, I wish we had several hours with our guest, Dr. Fuzz Rana. Boy, that music's a little loud there. All right, thanks. author of the new book, Creating Life in the Lab, and Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. Hey, folks, if you want to see the nice smiling face of the man known as Fuzz, go to reasons.org. I'm looking at his picture and Dr. Hugh Ross and others. What a great team. Tell us quickly how readers will benefit from your new book, Creating Life in the Lab, and then tell us about Reasons to Believe and what it does.
Well, you know, I think the book that I've written will prepare Christians for the inevitable announcement that scientists have indeed made life in the lab, which I expect will happen within the next few years. And so it's important, I think, for Christians to be prepared ahead of time to respond to that type of discovery and that type of an advance before it happens, so that we're not caught off guard when indeed it does happen and the claims come from the scientific community that God isn't necessary, again, because we've made life in the lab. And that's kind of the focus of the ministry that I work for, Reasons to Believe, is that we are devoted to showing how the latest advances in science support the Christian faith. And our website, it houses a huge number of resources, written articles, audio files, podcasts, video files that people can access for no cost that can help them navigate the sometimes tricky waters of science-based issues. And so we, again, are trying to communicate the idea that science and faith are allies, and that people who try to use science as a way to argue against the Christian faith actually don't have much of a leg to stand on when science-faith issues are properly understood.
And, you know, I always live with a sense of confidence because I know that God's promises and purposes will ultimately triumph, and I know the truth will ultimately triumph. But, you know, you hear a lot about, well, science knows this, science has proven this, and you think, you know, I was reading a scientific textbook that was 50 years old or 100 years old or 200 years old, and that stuff was all outdated and outmoded because science has learned something new now. And really, when the dust settles, people are going to be in awe and worship of our Creator God. The more we learn, the more in awe we're going to be.
Amen. And I think the creation testifies very powerfully to the Creator.
Absolutely. Hey, listen, if you folks ever have questions on Jewish apologetics or gay activism or other biblical issues, give me a call, and I will certainly give you folks a call with all of my scientific questions. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Dr. Fuzz Rana, the book, Creating Life in the Lab, the website reasons.org. I want to give you my bottom line thoughts for the day. The more we do study and learn, the clearer and clearer it becomes that there scientific evidence proves to us, demonstrates to us, shows us that there must be intelligence behind human life, life at all, the cell, DNA. Again, as a non-scientist, the more I look at things, the more I realize that there's no other explanation. There's nothing else that works. And I was listening to Richard Dawkins' clip the other day and just thinking to myself, you know, given enough time, if he'll be honest, he'll have to see the evidence only goes in one direction. Oh, I don't mean just when he stands before God. I mean the revelation that God has planted in nature. So bring it on. Let the newest scientific finds come forth. They will not undermine our confidence in the reality of God. In fact, the more we learn, the more we will recognize there is a creator of all. He is more awesome and amazing and mind-boggling than we could ever imagine. And as we bow down at his feet and worship now, forever and ever and ever, we'll be learning more about the glory and splendor of God. Don't cower back in unbelief and fear. There are strong reasons to believe. Above all, you can have a personal encounter with God. Hey, special broadcast coming your way this Friday. Be sure to tune in Friday for the Line of Fire this week.